We're now in a phase where everybody wants to do something with AI applications. So we have AI projects in many different parts of our organization, and they're all different and they all require a different approach. I recognize that a lot of people, especially here in the US, they see this tension between responsible use of AI or regulation and innovation, and this idea that once you start regulating or applying some ethics to the use of AI, you stifle innovation. I don't see it that way at all. These models, they can gobble up terabytes, petabytes of data without any problem. So yes, at a certain point, we're going to run out of data that we can put in there. Don't focus too much on the technology. Implementing AI in the organizations ultimately ends up being about people and processes.
Welcome to the Chief AI Officer Podcast, where AI meets leadership. And here is your host, Sanjay Puri.
Welcome to the CAIO Podcast, where we explore the transformative world of enterprise AI through conversations with leaders who are driving AI innovations across global organizations. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri. Today, we have a fascinating guest who leads AI initiatives at one of the world's most impactful organizations. Lambert Hogenhout is the Chief of Data and AI at the United Nations, where he oversees AI strategy and implementation across the UN's vast operations. He has over 20 years of experience in data analytics and emerging technologies. He also brings a unique perspective on using AI for global good. He's also a prolific writer and speaker on AI ethics, data privacy, and responsible technology. Welcome to the show, Lambert.
Thanks, Sanjay. Thanks for inviting me.
Great, Lambert. We have a global audience, people in policy, entrepreneurs, leaders in AI. So for them, can you just briefly walk them through your journey to becoming Chief of Data and AI at UN?
Sure, yeah. I've been with the UN for a long time. I started out in humanitarian affairs. So dealing with all the emergencies in the world, the tsunamis and earthquakes, civil wars, what have you, and providing all the technology that is needed for those. And then at some point, I moved to the central IT department. I started out there doing data visualization and analytics. This was about 10 years ago, and the tools were becoming better and stronger. And at the same time, like many organizations, I think we were going through some digital transformation. And for that, the data was very, very key, of course. And then as technology kept improving and maturing, we started using things like NLP and machine learning, so getting a little bit into AI. I was also overseeing innovation and emerging technologies at the time. And I think at first, the reaction to these AI forms of AI, especially the machine learning, was sort of lukewarm because people realize they have to organize all their data. You need lots and lots of data for that. And it was sort of lukewarm. But then recently, of course, with generative AI, things have become much, much easier. And now there's a lot of demand. So that has become the main focus of what we're doing, focusing on data and on the implementation of AI systems. Yeah.
So it's been a pretty interesting journey going from IT technology across the board to now machine learning to AI, because as I mentioned to Lambert, there are people who are listening to this show who aspire to be like you or aspire to lead AI initiatives. So for some of them, the journey can be in many, many different ways. Coming to your current role, you have a very complex and a very diverse organization like the United Nations. How, Lambert, do you approach implementing AI in such a complex organization?
Yeah, I think the first thing to realize is that AI is becoming more and more pervasive. So maybe in the past, it was an application for very specific purposes, the machine learning applications. we're now in a phase where everybody wants to do something with AI applications. So we have AI projects in many different parts of our organization, and they're all different and they all require a different approach. But I think if you look forward another couple of years, AI is going to be pervasive in everything we do. So it's not a matter of the quote-unquote AI team doing an application here or an application there. It needs to become a mindset and a way of thinking and a piece of knowledge and understanding that everybody across the organization has how AI can play a role in different aspects of the work. I think it's going to be part of every software that we get, whether it is workplace productivity software like word processors or enterprise systems for finance or human resources, or they're all going to have AI components in there. So it's on the one hand, it's good news. On the other hand, it takes the AI outside of one particular group that does AI. So you have to start really thinking enterprise-wide when you think about things like AI governance and standards and principles that you use.
So, Lambert, you made a very important point. And for our listeners who are rolling out AI initiatives, I just want to follow up. You said AI is going to be in everything that you do. That has implications for an organization from change management, from the talent, from reskilling, etc. Can you just talk at a high level to folks who are setting these things up? What should they be thinking about when you say all pervasive? So that implies that, even if you are, let's say, in procurement, or let's say you are in accounting or finance, it is going to have some touch points in there too. So there is some element of change management for that kind of stuff that is implied. But also leadership needs to be aware of that. So just talk a little bit briefly to our listeners about that.
Right. Yeah. The temptation might be when you think about all these sophisticated AI systems that, we need to get some talent. We need to get some experts who really know everything about how neural networks work and how these large language models work and these things. And sure, yeah, it's useful to have those. They're hard to find sometimes, but it's useful to have those. But I think what is more important is to look at how this is going to function in the organization, how you can anchor it in the organization. So that means creating awareness among all of the staff about what AI is, so they can think about it sensibly and see opportunities and use it sensibly, because they're going to be using it. Some of your staff may already, maybe secretly, if it's against company policy, they might be using one of these online tools, online generative AI systems, to help them write an email or summarize a report or something. So it's better to realize that and to give them some education so they can use it sensibly, that they also are aware of the limitations, the risks, and how to use these tools well. And then at the management level, you're talking more about the sort of the strategy. How is it going to impact our business? What are new opportunities with AI that we can do? And what are things that we are currently doing that might become obsolete, where sort of the business model no longer functions? And to have that understanding, to be able to have that foresight as senior leaders, you also need quite a bit of knowledge about AI. You need to know what is happening. You don't need to know the technical details, but you need to know what it can do. And so what we did in the UN, one of the things that I did for 2 years now, setting up a data literacy program, an academy. And increasingly, we have AI offerings in that as well. And it runs twice a year with physical instructors. It's remote, but it's instructor-led trainings. That is really meant to spread out this knowledge to all staff. And I think we have reached about 20% now of the staff worldwide that have taken one of these courses.
Wow. So really, you're democratizing AI across the enterprise, Lambert. And that's, again, a learning message for enterprises. Should enterprises roll those applications of AI out across the board? or should it be restricted within the IT department, etc.? What is your perspective?
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. Which application should you do first, and should it be centralized or decentralized? I think it really depends on the organization. But I think, as I said before, looking forward in a couple of years, AI is going to be everywhere. So it's going to be very, very hard for one entity to control all of that. It's more about providing the understanding and the awareness with everyone so they can take sensible decisions, and also providing some guiding principles, policies, whatever mechanisms you have in your organization, and standards, technical standards, both in terms of restricting what can be done and not be done with AI, but also in terms of enabling it, making it easier for people to have access to these tools.
So have give access, put some standards around it. Lambert, some of our listeners are involved in global companies that operate around the world, and you obviously are involved with an organization that you can't get more global. Talk to some of them about some of the unique challenges in deploying AI solutions across different cultures and regions globally.
From a UN perspective, of course, it's we have offices all around the world, and we have cultures and member states that you know we all need to be sensitive towards. So that's one challenge that we have. From a more corporate perspective, I'd say if you're a company that operates internationally, which is most companies these days have customers in different nations. One of the challenges is that the regulations are very fragmented. Every country has its own regulations, both on data and data privacy, personal data, and the regulations on AI are also starting to pop up in different countries. So it becomes very complex for a company. If you have an application that runs on servers in the US but has customers in Europe and their data is being processed in India, and the products are actually coming from Brazil, so the shipping needs to come from Brazil, you're dealing with four different jurisdictions, right? And that can become very complex. So it's something that you need to strategize about before you actually plan your operations, that, you know, what data do I need in which place and how am I going to process it to avoid getting into very difficult situations later. I wrote a book, I published a book about that last year from the data privacy perspective, how a company can develop a strategy taking into account all this global presence and the sort of the landscapes that they have to deal with. So, and for AI, it's a bit of the same challenge.
No, and I saw that book, and for our listeners, it's on Lambert's website too. But I think the point Lambert is making for our listeners who operate globally is make sure you are cognizant of regulations, whether it's in data or AI in the regions that you operate in. I think that's an important point as you deal with different regions and cultures. Lambert, besides the book that you wrote on data, you have also written extensively about ethical AI. And, you know, you work for an organization that has its own values, like a lot of other organizations do. Again, for our listeners, how do you ensure the AI development at the United Nations aligns with the values of the organizations?
Yeah, so one of the first things that we did when we realized that AI was becoming really big, that was about 2 years ago, we sat down with many different offices and departments and organizations within the UN family of organizations, and we developed some principles, how to use AI in a good way and prevent bad uses of AI. Of course, it's very easy to throw these words around, good and bad, but that means you have to define your ethics, right? You have to start defining what is good and what is bad. And that's not always easy. And I think if you do that as a company, you have various things you have to take into account. Of course, there might be regulations that you have to deal with. So that's one thing. There might also be principles that you stand for as a company. And I think that's a very important thing to also take into account. If you want to be authentic and genuine about those principles that you adhere to as a company, you want them to align with your values as a company. And then there's maybe cultural expectations, depending on the kind of audiences that you or customers that you serve in different countries. They may have certain cultural expectations. Subjecting people to AI decisions in some way might be okay for some communities, and in other places, in other groups of customers, that might not be okay. And the same with data privacy. So I think you need to take that into account. At the UN, of course, we had quite a few principles or foundational documents already: the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Geneva Convention, and many things that have been decided by countries together at the UN over the years. So we could base ourselves on that: human rights law, humanitarian law, these kind of things. But I think, that's something you need to do as a company as well, to make sure that when you use AI, that you do it in a way that doesn't violate the trust you have with your customers, with your partners, and also with your own staff.
Yeah, so make sure it aligns with your values and doesn't violate the trust that you have with customers, partners, employees. Lambert, I think that's a very important point that you made. Lambert, besides ethical AI, you also have been a strong advocate for responsible AI. What frameworks, and right now responsible, everybody is talking about responsible AI, a lot of chief AI officers that come on our show talk about it, but talk to them about some frameworks that you have found to be most effective.
Yeah, I think it's again something that you can base yourself on a lot of things that others have already figured out. There's a lot of risks about AI that are well recognized, things like bias or discrimination, unfairness, the risk of hallucinations, how much risk are you willing to take in that respect. So all of these things can be part of your framework for ethical AI. And I'm not inclined to point at one specific one. There's a number of very good frameworks, but I think you have to figure out what you're comfortable with and also how that is changing for you as a company, and also how that changes in the landscape. We defined principles of AI about 2 years ago, and I think in the meantime, things have changed. One of the things that I regret that we haven't put in there is something about ethical sourcing of data. You see a lot of these large language models now, they're being created by using people in countries where the wages are very low to train all the data for very small amounts, I think for $5 a day or something, or even less, $1 a day. Mm-hmm. And you might wonder, is that something that I want to encourage, right? But that's not something we thought about at the time, the ethical sourcing of data. And I think it's something that is still immature. If you ask people, where is your data coming from, right? And how was it processed? And who owns it, etc.? That whole provenance, that is something that is still an immature area, but it might be something that I think should become part of responsible AI as well. And if we go forward another 2-3 years, I'm sure there will be other things that pop up.
Oh, that's a very interesting point you made about ethical sourcing of data. You know, there was a 60 Minutes piece recently. I don't know if you saw, I think you're pointing towards this whole exercise of data labeling in Africa, where the wages have been an issue. But that would be, as you said, the industry, this AI is evolving so fast that it's going to need different standards that come up for sure. You also talked about, you know, data governance, and you have such a large global organization. What's your approach to data governance, Lambert, that some of your peers could probably learn from?
Yeah, I think, again, with data, you have to realize that there's no way, probably unless you're a very small organization, there's no way that you're going to have all the data of your organization in one sort of big data warehouse. I think we had that illusion 20 years ago when we talked about data warehouses, but it's not going to happen. There's more and more data available. People use data for all kinds of parts of their work, parts of a process in organization, and it's going to be very hard to centralize all of that. So you have to think with your governance processes, whether it is the standards, the metadata standards, the master data, the whether it is the documentation of data. We're in the process of implementing a data catalog that documents where data sits. That you have to work with all these people that own the data and create incentives for them to share that information of what data is available, because these incentives are not necessarily there traditionally, right? If my job is to produce some kind of a report or publication or something, and for that I need to collect all kinds of data, in my job description, it doesn't say store that data and enrich it so that it's really, really useful and share that with everybody else in the organization. That's probably not what it says in my job description. In my job description, it says produce this report. So that's what I'm going to do. And I think we need to think differently about that and to recognize the value of the data that is used in the process and make that part of people's output as well. Recognize that as part of people's key performance indicators that make it part of people's successes and reward them for it as well, recognize them for it. And that's not happening yet, but that needs to happen in the future.
So make sure that's part of the future job description in terms of making sure they're sourcing data in the right way, Lambert, is what your recommendation is to your peers.
And recognize the value of that data in addition to the product that comes out of it, but the data itself as well, and make that part of the deliverables as well.
So recognize the value of the data itself is what you're saying, not just what comes out of it. That's a very important point. Lambert, talk to us about an AI initiative at the UN which might have had a significant impact internally or externally to your stakeholders.
Well, there's a couple of good uses of AI that I can think of, and some of them are actually not new. We for a long time, I think, some of the UN organizations have been using AI for logistical planning. So when they need to send trucks to deliver food in different places. That is something that AI can be used for very well. The automatic recognition of video analysis of footage that we take, be it in humanitarian emergencies or be it security footage or these kind of video, you know, that takes hours and hours. There's hours and hours of these videos, and it's very tedious and time consuming for humans to analyze that. So that's another good opportunity. In things like agriculture and weather prediction, those are applications that are very useful. Farmers, concrete results where farmers can increase their productivity in fields because of the analysis that AI systems can give them of when is the best time to plant and where and how much and what kind of crops. So all of those are very good uses of AI.
Well, so these are actual tangible things which are really impacting the lives of people. When you talked about improving yields for farmers, when to plant crops and things of that nature. I mean, those are some fantastic applications. These are not just, hey, there's a chatbot, and not that there's something wrong with chatbots. They're also very important, but these are things that are having some significant impact. Lambert, one of the, in the discussions I have with chief AI officers who are leading large enterprise AI applications, is always the tug and pull between innovation and responsibility when it comes to AI deployment. What are your thoughts in terms of balancing innovation and responsibility when it comes to AI development?
Yeah, I recognize that a lot of people, especially here in the US, they see this tension between responsible use of AI or regulation and innovation, and this idea that once you start regulating or applying some ethics to the use of AI, you stifle innovation. I don't see it that way at all. I see it. I see the responsible use of AI as something that increases the chances of success of innovations. There was a couple of interesting articles in the Harvard Business Review earlier this year about culture in organizations and why AI projects failed to take off. And a lot of it had to do with mistrust within the organization. It's not even about the customers. That's another risk, right? Reputational loss with your customers if there's a backlash. But even within their own organizations, the staff was very distrustful about what was going on with AI. And that led to problems in the implementation. So being extremely clear as a company about how we are going to use AI, what are the parameters, the guardrails, what are we going to do and not do with AI? Mm-hmm. If you can have that transparency and that clarity, you can remove a lot of the mistrust and probably increase the chances of success of your innovations. So I don't see these two being in conflict.
So what you're saying is actually guardrails, responsibility, actually could potentially enhance innovation because you have a clear road that is laid out in so many ways for people to know that this is the path to go through. So exactly. There is no tug and a pull here. So that's important to know.
And it mitigates some of the risks that you typically have when you innovate and create new projects. What are some of the reasons for it to fail? You can take them away by using AI responsibly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Lambert, UN has sustainable development goals that have been laid out. A lot of our companies are also now, marching towards them. Has AI played a role in supporting UN sustainable development goals?
Well, it would be very hard to say no to that question because the Sustainable Development Goals really address almost the entire gamut of human life, right? Anything mm-hmm. from poverty to education to gender equality to human rights to the health of our planet, our oceans. It's everything, right? Mm-hmm. So I mentioned a few examples of the uses of AI already, but I think in all of these, I forgot to mention health is an important one of the mm-hmm. SDGs, and a lot is being done with AI to support research in health and to, you have AlphaFold automatically predicting the shapes of molecules. This will give an enormous push to research in the field of health. So, all of the SDGs are probably going to benefit from AI.
Well, that's an important aspect to that, Lambert. Lambert, a lot of discussion is going on in terms of sovereign AI or AI model localization, because generally a lot of countries are saying, hey, we want to have our own AI, which addresses our culture, our languages, and things of that nature. You have a bird's eye view sitting at the UN because you, as you said, you are across every country in the world. What are your thoughts on AI model localization for different regions?
I'll speak specifically to the generative AI and large language models. And I see that we need to move to richer content being part of these training data sets. I think when researchers were first trying to create these LLMs, what they were trying to do is create a system that can have a natural conversation with a human, right? Pass the Turing test or something to have that conversational capability. And they succeeded in that. And they were so successful that people started conversing with these chatbots online. And it felt so natural. It felt like talking to a person that knows pretty much everything. So people started to use it as a knowledge base, as a sort of an oracle. Taking seriously everything that it said. But that's not how they were designed in order to create that conversational capability. All kinds of data was thrown in, not really looking at the variety of that data, at the veracity of that data, the sort of diversity of that data. To think now that these training sets, these large language models, is sort of the canon of knowledge that we want to base all our information on, that would be really, really bad. So I think now that we know that the conversational part, that's more or less solved, we need to go back and say, okay, what is the body of knowledge that we want these AI systems to know? And I think that needs to be probably more global, and it needs to be specific for different regions. When I travel around the world and talk to people, I say, yes, within this region or within this country, you should look at some of these foundation models and create models that have a lot of your things in your language, content in your language, and that represents your culture as well. If I go to one of these image generating AI systems and I ask for a picture of breakfast, I can guarantee you what comes out is bacon and eggs. And if you go to Mexico, they probably eat tortillas for breakfast, right? If you go to India, maybe they'll have idli. You go to Japan, they'll have miso soup. In Switzerland, they'll have muesli. 90% of the world eats a very different breakfast. And yet, what the only thing that these large language models know is bacon and eggs. And that's a very limited view of the world. That needs to change.
Yeah, and that's a big discussion, especially when you start looking at the global south that comes in. Lambert, just taking that point that you have made, recently, there's been a lot of discussion that these large language models, these foundation models, are basically run out of data because there's only so much data on the internet. Do you think when you talked about, going to these other countries, regions, languages, maybe there is an additional source of data that we have that has not been tapped in?
That's true, but I think it's two different issues. One issue is that the data contained in these models is primarily English language or Chinese language, and it's sort of narrow in its cultural diversity. And that's one issue, and that needs to be enriched. And there is lots of content in various parts of the world. So that from a financial perspective, it might not be that interesting, but I think from a culture perspective, that is extremely interesting. The second part is that these models, they can gobble up terabytes, petabytes of data without any problem. So yes, at a certain point, we're going to run out of data that we can put in there. And I think that's a real concern. If I look 5 years ahead or 10 years ahead, with these models being so easily producing content, be it journalistic articles or even whole books or even songs or poetry or anything, it sort of takes away the incentive for humans to produce content. because it can be done within seconds and so much cheaper. So why would humans do that? You can't really compete. But if the humans stop doing that, then within the next 2 years, we're going to reach that point where all the language models are going to eat their own exhaust, right? Because anything new that's produced is actually produced by AI. And
That's the
that's
synthetic data, basically, is what you're saying.
and right, yeah. So we're getting to a point where they can't go any further, and I see that as a big risk. And I think, you know, there's lots of considerations about AI that are not immediate, that are sort of the what I call the medium-term considerations, five to 10 years, that people are not thinking enough about, right? We can replace the content production of humans by AI, but if we do that, you know, what content are we left with 5 years from now? And that I don't think people are thinking enough about that.
Yeah, that's a very important point is once we become reliant on the AI, basically it's the AI that is producing the data, and that's the argument about synthetic data versus human-generated data. Lambert, I could go on and on. There's so many different topics that I wanted to cover, but maybe we'll have you back again. But we do have a lightning round of quick questions, which we would love to get one-word answers from you. It's to again for our listeners who are fascinated about how you think about things. So, are you ready for that?
Let's try it.
Okay. So, Lambert, cloud or on-premise?
Oh, I think that depends on the situation.
Okay. Supervised or unsupervised learning?
Again, depends on the situation.
GPUs or TPUs?
I think there'll be a new kind of chips.
New kind of chips. Okay. Open source or proprietary AI?
Open source.
Open source. Okay. I asked this a little before, but let's, try again. Synthetic data or human-generated data?
Human.
Human. Okay. Lambert, for our listeners who are in organizations who are looking to scale their AI initiatives, what's one actionable piece of advice that you would like to leave them with?
Don't focus too much on the technology. Implementing AI in the organizations ultimately ends up being about people and processes. So start with that, and the technology will sort itself out. It's becoming more capable every couple of months. So don't focus on that primarily.
So, to our listeners, I think Lambert's making a very important point. Don't focus as much on technology, which will sort itself out. Focus on your business, your operations. And that, in a way, he's kind of also alluding to if you're hiring the kind of people that you are, maybe that's something you want to keep in mind. Lambert, this has been fascinating, and to our listeners, it really wraps up our very fascinating conversation with Lambert. His insights on leading AI initiatives at the UN while still maintaining a very strong ethical framework can offer valuable lessons for organizations of all sizes, global. I mean, you can't get more global than UN. And thank you, really, for sharing your expertise with our audience and our listeners. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Chief AI Officer podcast. And don't forget to subscribe and join us next time as we continue to explore the world of enterprise AI leadership. Until then, keep innovating responsibly. Thank you so much, Lambert, for being on the podcast.
It was my pleasure, Sanjay.
Thank you.